Chapter 19. The first break in the long, long wait through dread, even though it was a totally incomprehensible break, came in May 1960. It happened when Marco was late for a 2 o'clock date with Raymond at Hungarian Charlie's booze outlet across the street from the Flash shop. It was a fairly well-known fact to practically anyone who did not like batteries for his hearing aid that Hungarian Charlie was one of the more stridently loquacious publicans in that not unsilent business. Only one other Boniface, who operated farther north on 51st Street, had a bigger mouth. Charlie talked as though Sigmund Freud himself had given permission, nay, had urged him, to tell everyone everything that came into his head, and in bad grammar yet. 10 minutes before Marco got to the saloon, with Raymond seated at bar center, staring at a glass of beer on a slow afternoon, Charlie had pinned a bookmaker at the entrance end of the bar, a man who would much rather have talked to his new friend, a young dumpy blonde with a face like a bat's and the thirst of a burning oil field. Charlie was telling them, loud and strong, hearty and healthy, about his wife's repulsive older brother who lived with them, and about how he had followed Charlie all over the apartment all day Sunday, telling him what to do with his life, which was a new development brought on by the fact that he had just inherited $2,300 from a deceased friend whom he had been engaged to marry for 14 years, which was a generous thing for her to have done when it was seen from the perspective, Charlie said, that this bum had never given the broad so much as a box of talcum powder for Christmas, it having been his policy always to pick a fight with her, immediately preceding gift-exchanging occasions.
"Listen," Charlie yelled. "You inherit that kind of money and you naturally feel like you know all the answers, and also puts me in a position where I can't exactly kick him in the ankle, you know what I mean? So with the new pern of you, I say that I'm very patient. Why don't you pass the time by playing a little solitaire?"
Raymond was on a bar stool 12 feet away from Charlie, and had in no way been eavesdropping on the conversation, as that could have been judged suicidal. He rapped on the bar peremptorily with a half dollar. Charlie looked up, irritated. One lousy customer in the whole lousy joint, and he had to be a point killer.
"What already?" Charlie inquired.
"Give me a deck of cards," Raymond said. Charlie looked at the bookmaker, then rolled his eyes heavenward. He shrugged his shoulders like the tenor in Tosca, opened a drawer behind him, took out a blue bicycle deck, and slid it along the polished surface to Raymond. Raymond took the deck from its box and began to shuffle smoothly and absent-mindedly, and Charlie went back to barbering the bookmaker and the young dumpy blonde. Raymond was laying down the second solitaire spread when Marco came in 10 minutes later. He greeted Charlie as he passed him, ordering a beer, then stood at the bar at Raymond's elbow.
"I got held up in traffic," he said ritualistically, "and so forth."
Raymond didn't answer.
"Are you clear for dinner, Raymond?"
Marco wasn't aware that Raymond was ignoring him.
"My girl insists that the time has come to meet you, and no matter how I try to get out of it, that's the way it's got to be. Besides, I am about to marry the little thing, ringside, £139, and we would like you to be the best man."
The Queen of Diamonds showed at the 23rd card turn. Raymond scooped the cards together, ignoring Marco. Become aware of the silence, Marco was studying Raymond. Raymond squared the deck, put it face down on the top of the bar, placed the Queen of Diamonds face up on top of the stack and stared at it, in a detached and preoccupied manner, unaware that Marco was there. Charlie put the glass of beer in front of Marco at the rate of 137 words a minute, decibel count well above the middle register, then turned, walking back to the bookmaker and the broad, to punctuate his narrative by recalling the height of the repartee with his brother-in-law.
"Why don't you take a cab quick to Central Park and jump in a lake," I says.
And his voice belted it loud and strong, as though a sound engineer were riding gain on it. Raymond brushed past Marco, walked rapidly past the bookmaker and the girl, and out of the saloon.
Hey, Raymond," Marco yelled. "Where you going?"
Raymond was gone. By the time Marco got to the street, he saw Raymond slamming the door of a cab. The taxi took off fast, disappearing around the corner, going uptown. Marco returned to the saloon. He sipped at his beer with growing anxiety. The action of the game of solitaire nagged at him, until he placed it in the dreams. It was one of the factors in the dreams that he had placed no meaning upon because he had come to regard the game as aberration that had wriggled into the fantasy. He had discussed it because it had been there, but after one particularly bright young doctor said that Raymond had undoubtedly been doing something with his hands which had looked as though he were playing solitaire, Marco had gradually allowed the presence of the game in the dream to dim and fade. He now felt the conviction that something momentous had just happened before his eyes, but he did not know what it was. "Hey, Charlie." Business of rolling eyes heavenward, business of slow turn, exaggerating the forbearance of an extremely patient man.
"Yeah, already. Does Mr. Shaw play solitaire in here much?" "What do you mean, much?"
"Did he ever play solitaire in here before?"
"No."
"Give me another beer." Marco went to the telephone booth, digging for change. He called Lou Amjack. Amjack sounded sourer than ever.
"What the hell happened to you?"
"Come on, save time. What happened?"
"Raymond is at the 22nd Precinct in the middle of the park on the 86th Street transverse."
"What did he do?"
"What the hell is the matter with you?" "He rented a rowboat, and he jumped in the lake."
"If you're kidding me, Lou."
"I'm not kidding you."
"I'll meet you there in 10 minutes.
Colonel Marco."
"What?"
"Did it finally break?"
"I think so. Yeah, I think so." At first, Raymond flatly denied he had done such a thing. But when the shock and embarrassment had worn off and he was forced to agree that his clothes were sopping wet, he was more nearly ready to admit that something which tended toward the unusual had happened. He, Amjack, and Marco sat in a squad room at Marco's request. When Raymond seemed to have done with sputtering and expostulating, Marco spoke to him in a low, earnest voice, like a dog trainer, in a manner too direct to be evaded. "We've been kidding each other for a long time, Raymond, and I put up with it because I had no other choice. You didn't believe me. You decided I was sick and that you had to go along with the gag to help me. Didn't you, Raymond?" Raymond stared at his sodden shoes.
"Raymond, am I right?"
"Yes."
"Now hear this. You stood beside me at Hungarian Charlie's, and you didn't know I was there. You played a game of solitaire. Do you remember that?"
Raymond shook his head. Marco and Amjack exchanged glances.
"You took a cab to Central Park. You rented a rowboat. You rowed to the middle of the lake. Then you jumped overboard. You have always been as stubborn as a dachshund, Raymond. But we can produce maybe 30 eyewitnesses who saw you go over the side, then walk to shore. So don't tell me again that you never did such a thing. And stop kidding yourself that they are not inside your head. We can't help you if you won't help us."
"But I don't remember," Raymond said. Something had happened to permit him to feel fear. Josie was coming home. He might have something to lose. The creeping paralysis of fright was so new to him that his joints seemed to have rusted.